Chapter 16. The Legacy. That our beloved hive should be conquered, or should fall into the controlling hands of unwise or unfit masters, I greatly fear and sadly anticipate. For this reason, I entrust this ultimate sanction to you. Use it wisely. Hieronymo Sondar, to Lord Chass.
It has been in the trust of my family since the trade war,
she explained, her voice broken and exhausted. Gaunt took the amulet from her hands and felt it purr and whisper between his fingers. Sondar made this.
It was his provision for the future. It is, in its own way, treachery.
Explain it again. I cannot see how this is treachery.
Merity Chass looked up into Gaunt's tired eyes fretfully.
Vervenhive is a democratic legislative. The High Lord is voted in by his noble peers. It is written in the sacred arts of constitution that absolute power should never be allowed to rest with any one individual who could not be unseated by the legislature, should it become necessary.
Yet the hive has suffered under one individual. Salvador.
Precisely the kind of evil Hieronymo dreaded, Commander. My father told me that after the trade war, Great Hieronymo wished to vouchsafe the future security of Vervenhive. Above all else, he feared a loss of control, that an invader or a ruler not fit for the role would seize control of Vervenhive so entirely that nothing could unseat him. What usurper or tyrant observes the mechanisms of constitution and law?
Gaunt began to understand the far-reaching political dilemma attached to the device in his gloved hand. So this was his failsafe, the ultimate sanction so very undemocratic, to be used when democracy was overturned.
And so you understand why it had to be a secret. Hieronymo knew that by constructing such a device he would lay himself open to accusations of tyranny and dictatorship.
She gestured towards the amulet.
He made that and entrusted it to House Chass, whom he considered the most humanitarian and neutral noble house. It was never made to fall into the hands of any ruler. It was the safeguard against totalitarian rule.
And if House Chass became the High House?
We were to entrust it to another, as surety against our misuse of power.
And you give it to me?
You are the future of Vervenhive now, Gaunt. Why do you think my father made such efforts to evaluate you? He needed to be certain such insurance would not be handed to one who might abuse it. He knew you were no tyrant in the making, and I see that too. You are a soldier, true and brave, with nothing but the survival of our hive in your dreams.
Your father died well, Merity Chass.
I'm glad to hear it. Honor him and the duty borne by his house, Ibram Gaunt. Do not prove him wrong.
Gaunt studied the amulet. It was a system slayer, and, from what the girl said, quite the most powerful and formidable example of its kind he had ever heard of. In the time of Hieronymo, House Sondar had specialized in codifier systems and sentient cogitators, and they had enjoyed long-term trade partnerships and research pacts with the tech mages of the Adeptus Mechanicus. This was the masterpiece. In the event of anyone achieving total technological mastery of Vervenhive, the activation of this amulet would annihilate the command and control systems, erase all data and function programs, corrupt all codifiers, and lobotomize all cogitators. It would cripple Vervenhive and allow the device's wielders to free the hive from would-be conquerors now rendered helpless. In its peculiar way, it was more potent than atomics or a chapter of the Adeptus Astartes. It was an ultimate weapon, forged for arenas of battle far beyond the remit of a dog soldier like Gaunt. It was war on a refined, decisive level, light-years away from the mud and lasfire theatres that Gaunt regularly experienced. Still, he understood it. But he didn't like it. Such ancient high technology was a fearful thing, like psycho witchcraft. He set it down on the pew next to him. It gurgled and hummed, system patterns reconfiguring like sunlight on moving water across its smooth casing.
We don't need it.
Merity Chass stiffened and stared up at the stained glass rosette of the sacristy.
I was afraid you'd say that.
She turned to face him. Her face was pale, and her eyes were angry and dark. Multicolored light from the window behind her created a halo around her slim form.
My father agonized about using it. When I reached the shelters and found he had hidden it in my belongings, I agonized too. Even as I came here to find you, I realized we had left it too late. You have already unseated cursed Salvador. Our dire situation is no longer a matter of control.
We have control, Gaunt agreed. The problem is now simply one of physical warfare. Though Vervenhive stands at the brink of doom, it is not the doom Hieronymo feared, or planned for, with this. She sat down next to him, smoldering with rage.
If only I had brought it sooner, or urged my father to do the same. We could have used it to overthrow Salvador.
Praise the throne, we did not. She glanced around at him sharply. Gaunt shrugged. We'd have crippled ourselves, crippled the hive systems, left ourselves with nothing to use to regain control. A system slayer is an absolute weapon, lady.
So my soul-searching, my father's painstaking deliberations, were all pointless anyway?
She laughed a thin, scratchy laugh.
How fitting. House Chass, so gacking intellectual and refined, agonizing over nothings while the hive bleeds and burns.
He pulled off his gloves and tossed them aside. Hieronymo's legacy was never to be taken lightly. That we can't use it now does not reflect badly on the care and devotion with which House Chass held that trust. She reached out her hand and clasped his calloused fingers.
What happens now, Gaunt?
Slowly, he looked round at her. We fight a simple war. Men and machines. Lasguns and shells. We fight and try to drive them out. If we win, we live. If we lose, we die.
It sounds so bleak.
It's all I know. The crude equation of battle. It's not so bad. It's simple, at least. There's no deliberation involved.
How long?
How long what? Her eyes, more alive than anything Gaunt had ever seen, gazed into his.
How long before we know?
Ibram Gaunt exhaled deeply, shaking his head. Just hours now. Perhaps a day. Perhaps two. Then it will be over, one way or another. She pulled him to her, her arms stretched tightly around his broad back. He could smell her hair and her perfume, faint and almost worn away, but still tangible despite the odors of cold and damp and dirt she had been exposed to in the shelters. Gaunt had long forgotten the simple consolation of another's body warmth. He held her gently, swimming with fatigue, as the low voices of the ecclesiarch choir ebbed through the sacristy. Her mouth found his. He pulled back.
I don't think, he began. A common soldier, messing with a high-born lady.
She smiled.
Even if that mattered once, it doesn't now. This war has made us all equals.
They kissed again, neither resisting. For a while, their passion was all that mattered to either of them. Two human souls, intimate and wordless, shutting the apocalypse out. Midnight was long past. Bray's Tanith units, after a day and night of tank-busting in the slag reaches of the Chem Plant District, fell back through the battered central hab zone towards the shield pylon. All the Zoikan southern efforts seemed to be directed at the pylon, and Bray knew that its strategic importance was unmatched by anything in the hive. Bray had about 280 Tanith left, augmented by 400 more Vervan Primary, Volpone, Rowan, and North Cole stragglers, plus around 600 hivers. The hivers were mostly non-coms, who looked to the troops for protection, and Bray and his colleague officers found themselves managing more of a refugee exodus than a troop retreat. But some of the hivers had consolidated into scratch units, adding about 170 fighting bodies to Bray's forces. More than half of the scratch companies were made up of women, and Bray was amazed. He'd never seen women fight. Back on Tanith, war was a masculine profession, but he couldn't deny their determination, and he understood it. This was their fething home, after all. Bray's immediate command chain was formed by Vervan Primary and North Coll, but though some of them outranked him, they looked to him for leadership. Bray suspected this was because Gaunt was now field commander. Everyone deferred to the Tanith now the endgame had begun. Shells from Zoikan armor whooped over his head, and Bray sprinted into a trench stretch between a blown-out meat-curing plant and a guild estate mansion. In the trench,
Sergeant Zweck of the North Col and Major Bunce of the Vervan Primary were directing the men around the curing plant to engage the enemy's forward push. Lasfire zagged down at them. Most of the Imperial shooters fired from shallow foxholes at the ranks of Zoican assault troops advancing, bayonets fixed, across the rubble. Mortar shells rebounded off the rock-crete slag and exploded as airbursts, causing significantly more damage. Behind the toppling lines of Zoican infantry, tanks rumbled in, many carrying troops clinging to the hull netting like apes. Bray fired his weapon over the trench lip. Beside him, Zweck was decapitated by airburst splinters. Blood saturated the side of Bray's dark fatigues. He reached for another clip.
"What are their names?" Kafran yelled over the pounding thunder of the tanks. He had Yonsi under one arm and was leading Dalin by the hand.
Tona hurried after him. Scratch companies to their west were holding the Zoican front back, and they were struggling to keep up with the straggle of civilian refugees fleeing into the northern sectors. Kafran yelled again. Tona Creed was busy and didn't answer Kafran. She was firing her las pistol at the Zoican assault troops crossing into the street behind her. But she was in trouble. There was no one to cover her.
"Hold tight to your brother and get down,"
Kafran cried at Dalin, pressing the swaddled baby into the boy's arms.
"I'm going back for your mother."
"She's not my mother. She's Auntie Tona," said Dalin.
Kafran glanced back confused and then ran on as las bursts flickered around him. He fired his las gun wildly and dropped into the shell hole where Tona cowered.
"Fresh clip," she called.
He tossed her one, reloaded, both rose and sent a stinging waft of killfire down the street at the Zoicans. Ochre bodies crumpled.
"Good shots. You're scary, Tona. I do what I do. Fresh clip."
He tossed her another.
"So they aren't yours. I thought you looked too young."
Tona swung round to him, her face hard.
"They're all I have. Gak you. You won't take them from me, and neither will these bastards."
She swung up and fired her gun, killing one, two, three. Savage fighting continued unabated on all fronts, right through into the early hours of the 36th day. By then, two-thirds of the Hive's immense civilian population were packed into the northeastern sectors and docks, making desperate efforts to flee to the north bank. The flow was far beyond the abilities of the river ferries to manage. Working through the night, with only brief pauses to refuel, boats like the Magnificat shuttled back and forth across the Hass. Over 2 million refugees were now in the outhabs of the North Shore or clogging the northern collective highway. The night was cold and wet, and many, wounded, shocked, or unfed, suffered with exposure and fever. In the Hive, it was worse. Millions choked the approaches to the wharves or lined the river in ranks as thick as the crowds on the terraces of the stadium watching a big game. Brutal battles broke out as citizens fought to win places on the approaching boats. Thousands died, almost 200 of them aboard a ferry that was overloaded and capsized in a panic rush to get aboard. Hundreds more were trampled or simply crushed in the press or were pushed into the river by the mounting weight of bodies behind them. Those that didn't drown immediately died slowly, floundering in the cold of the water, unable to find enough room on the docks to clamber back ashore. An entire pier stretch collapsed under the weight of the refugees, spilling hundreds into the Hass. Rioting and panic fighting spread like wildfire back through the crowds. Like a wounded, enraged animal, Vervan Hive began to claw and tear at itself. Every small boat or craft that could be found was stolen and put to the water, usually overfilled and often guided by men or women with no idea of watercraft. Hundreds of others elected to try to swim or paddle across, clinging to packing bales or other items of floating material. The Hass was almost 3 kilometers wide, icy cold and plagued with strong currents. No one who tried to swim made it more than halfway before perishing, except for a very few who were pulled out of the water by passing ferry crews. Streams of evacuees made it up from the docks onto the great viaduct and crossed on foot. The density of foot traffic on the rail bridge was so great that many were pushed off and fell screaming into the river far below. Just after midnight, Zoican rockets rained down the dock basin from the invading forces at the Heraldi bridge end to the east. Some fell on the docks or hit the water. 4 blew out the central spans of the viaduct, toppling 3 of the great brick pier supports and killing hundreds. The viaduct as an evacuation route was finished, and those pressed onto the southern spans who had survived the rocket strike were trapped. unable to retreat back into the hive and reach the docks because the pressure of bodies behind them was so great. One by one, they were pushed off the shattered end of the viaduct. A little after the destruction of the rail bridge, Follick, steering his ferry on a return run across the Haas, saw lights and movement on the north shore to the east. Zeuchen motorized brigades were sweeping in along the far shore from the pipelines and the Heraldi Road, pincering round to deny the escape route. The Zeuchens clearly intended no one should survive the destruction of the hive. By dawn, the Zeuchen army groups were assaulting the tides of refugees on the north bank. The hordes who had been lucky enough to get across the river were now systematically massacred on the far side. Perhaps as many as 500,000 were slaughtered outright. Hundreds of thousands fled, their numbers dissipating into the inhospitable hinterlands or the ruined outhabs. Now there was no way across. The ferries returned to the south docks, many under fire from Zeuchen forces on the north side, and tied up. They were as trapped as the hosts on the banks now. A fearful hush of realization fell across the multitude when they saw flight was no longer an option. The Zeuchens began to fire across the river into the tightly packed refugees. Despite the wholesale killing, it was a matter of hours before the civilian masses began to draw back into the hive. It took that long for the message to filter back through the press of humanity to adjust their tidal flow. Follick sat with Mintza on the foredeck of the rocking Magnificat, sharing a bottle of Jalik. They had decided not to flee. There seemed little point, especially now they were both roaring drunk. Sporadic enemy fire from across the Haas stippled the waters around them and smacked off the hull. Parts of the docks were ablaze now. Follick expected a rocket or mortar to blow them out of the water at any moment. He fetched another bottle from the wheelhouse, and a las round punched straight through the cabin window and out the other side over his shoulder as he stooped to reach into the steerage locker. It made him laugh. He stumbled back to Mintza. They decided to see if they could finish the bottle before they were killed. Haas West Fort was encircled by the enemy and under siege. By dawn, it was close to destruction. Shells and rockets rattled into it from outside the curtain wall, and enemy troops and light armor pounded it from the manufactories and habs within. Captain Cargin, badly wounded, held his men together, barely 600 of the 5,000 with which he had started the night. There were virtually no gunners or artillerymen left alive, but that hardly mattered because all the munitions for the wall and fort gun emplacements and missile racks were spent. The Vervan primary troopers and their lasguns were all that remained. The fort itself was rattled with damage, and lower levels were blocked or ablaze. Cargin adjusted his spiked helmet and limped down the gate battlement, urging his men with a voice hoarse from hours of shouting. The rock-crete deckways were littered with dead. One of his men, Corporal Anglon, called to him. Through the smoke and flames, he had sighted something approaching through the outer habs. Cargin took a look. Through his scope, he saw a colossal shape crawling through the suburb ruins 15 kilometers south of the fort. Another death machine, he thought instinctively. But this was different. Larger, slower. A huge pyramid structure, 500 meters high at the apex, its mechanical sides painted Zeuchen ochre and decorated with vast, obscene symbols of chaos. It moved, as far as he could see, on dozens of fat, wide-gauge caterpillar units that crushed everything in its path. A gouged trail half a kilometer wide scored through the habs in its wake. Its flanks bristled with weapon turrets and emplacements, and huge brass speaker horns on its summit, with chaos banners fluttering from poles between them, boomed out the Herita chant and crackled the inhuman chatter.
"What is it?"
Anglon hissed. Cargin shrugged. He was cold and weak from blood loss and pain. Every word, movement, or thought was an effort of superhuman concentration. He unstrapped the handset of the Vox unit he had been carrying over his shoulder since his comm officer had been killed some hours before.
"Cargin Haas West to Baptistry Command. Marker code 454GAU.
Received and recognized, Haas West.
We've got something out here, approaching the walls. Massive mechanized structure, mobile, armed. I'm only guessing, but unless there's more than one of these things, I'd lay real money. It's the enemy's command center. I've never seen a mobile unit so big."
"Understood, Haas West. Can you supply visuals?"
"Picked links are down, Command. You'll just have to take my word for it."
"What is your situation, Haas West? We are trying to direct troop forces to support you."
Coggin sighed. He was about to tell Baptistry Command he had less than 1,000 men left, most of them wounded, at the end of their ammo supplies, with no artillery support, and an ocean of enemy on all sides. He was about to estimate they could hold on another hour at the most. The estimate would have been inaccurate by 59.5 minutes. Anglong grabbed Cargin's arm, shouting out as fierce lights blinked and fizzled in dark recesses down the center of the pyramid side facing them. The vast Zoikan vehicle shuddered and then retched huge, searing beams of plasma energy at Hass West Fort, cutting beams like the ones that had dissected Ontabi Gate, but larger still and far more powerful, energy weapons of a scale usually seen in the fleet engagements of naval flagships. The roar was deafening, sending out a shockwave that was felt kilometers away. Hass West Fort and the gate it protected were obliterated. Cargin, Anglon, and all the remaining defenders were disintegrated in one blinding instant. As the cutting beams faded, rocket and gunnery platforms all across the pyramid opened fire and piled destruction on the ruins. The air stank with ozone and static and physoline. For half a kilometer in each direction, the curtain wall collapsed. The pyramid machine began to trundle forward again, inching towards the dying hive, blaring the Heritor's name over and again. Gaunt woke with a start, his mind spinning. Sleep had taken away his immediate fatigue, but every atom of his body ached and throbbed. It took him a moment to remember where he was. How long had he been asleep? He clambered to his feet. The sacristy was chilly and silent. The ecclesiarch choir, long since finished. Merity Chas stood nearby, gazing at the friezes of the imperial cult. She wore his long overcoat and nothing else. She looked round at him and smiled.
You'd better get dressed. They probably need you.
Gaunt recovered his shirt and boots and pulled them on. He could still taste her on his lips. He stared at her for a moment more.
She was beautiful.
If he didn't have a reason to fight for Vervenhive before, he did now. He would not allow this girl to perish. He sat down on the pew and laughed to himself dryly.
What?
She asked. Gaunt shook his head. Such thoughts. He had committed the cardinal sin of any good officer. He'd placed his emotions in the firing line. Even now he could hear Oktar's dirty chuckle in his mind, scolding him for becoming attached to anyone or anything. Over the years they had spent campaigning together, Gaunt had seen Oktar leave many tearful women behind as he moved on to the next war zone.
Don't get involved, Ibram, not with anything. If you don't care, you won't care, and that makes the hardest parts of this army life that much easier. Do what you must, take what you need, and move on. Never look back, never regret, and never remember.
Gaunt buttoned his shirt. He realized, perhaps for the first time, that he had broken with Oktar's advice a long time since. When he had met the Tanith and had brought them as ghosts from the death fires of their world, he had started to care. He decided he didn't see it as a weakness. In that one thing, old Oktar had been wrong. Caring for the ghosts, for the cause, for the fight, or for anyone, made him what he was. Without those reasons, without an emotional investment, he would have walked away or put a gun muzzle in his mouth years before. Gaunt got to his feet and found his cap, his gloves, and his weapon belt. He was trying to remember the furious notions that had woken him. Ideas, whirling. Dower burst into the sacristy.
Commissar, sir, we...
Dower saw the naked woman cloaked in the overcoat and stopped in his tracks. He turned away, flushing. A moment, Captain. Gaunt crossed to Merity.
I must go. When this is over, we'll either be dead, or we'll be a noble lady and a soldier once again.
Then I thank the Emperor for this precious interlude of equality. Until the hour of my death, however far away that is, I will remember you.
I should hope so, and I hope that hour is a long time coming.
He kissed her mouth, stroked his fingers down her cheek, and then followed Dower out of the sacristy, pulling on his jacket and weapon harness. At the door, he put on his cap and adjusted the metal rose Lord Chas had given him for honor. It was drooping in his lapel, and he straightened it.
Sorry, sir,
Dower said as Gaunt followed him down the hall.
Forget it, Ban. You should have woken me earlier.
I wanted to give you all the rest you could get, sir.
What's the situation now?
A holding pattern as before. Intense fighting on all fronts.
The enemy has taken the north shore, and Hass West fell a few minutes ago.
Damn! Gaunt growled. They strode into the bustle of the Baptistry Command Center. Additional cogitators and vox sets had been added overnight. Over 300 men and women from Vervan Primary, the Administratum, and the Guilds now crewed them, working in concert with dozens of servitors. Major Ott was occupying the Font, as the command station was now known. Intendant Bainfail and members of his elite staff assisted the Major. Many saluted as Gaunt entered the chamber. He acknowledged the greetings while taking in the details of the main hololithic display.
Just before it fell, Hass West reported seeing a massive mobile structure moving in towards them. We are fairly sure it is their main command vehicle.
Gaunt spotted the marker on the display. The thing was certainly huge, and now close to the western extremity of the wall. The marker code. Spike? Bainfail joined them. The distinguished lord was almost dead on his feet with fatigue.
My fault, Commissar. I referred to it as a bloody great spike, and the word stuck.
It'll do. What do we know about it?
It's a massive weapon, but slow-moving,
Major Ott said, crossing the floor to Gaunt.
I guess we can assume it's well-armored, too.
What makes you think it's the command element?
It's the only one we sighted,
Dara said,
and its size clearly indicates its importance.
More than that, Bainfail said, gesturing at a vox set manned by a female administratum cleric, two servitors and a withered astropath.
It's the source of the chatter.
Gaunt glanced at the woman operating the set. She dialed up the speaker, and the air filled briefly with the coded, incessant growl of the enemy.
The enemy vox traffic unites them all,
lisped the pallid astropath thickly. Gaunt tried not to look at him, and the festoon of data plugs stapled into his translucent scalp. The astropath lifted a bionically augmented, wasted limb and pointed to data runes flashing across the instrumentation.
We knew it was coming from outside the hive, and we suspected the source was Zoika. But it's mobile now, and audio scans confirm it is being emitted by that structure.
Gaunt nodded to himself. Asphodel. Bainfail glanced around at the name.
He's there. So close.
It matches his recorded behavior. The Heritor likes to be near to his triumphs, and he likes to maintain intense control. He commands by charisma, Intendant. Where his legions march, we will not find him far behind.
Golden throne,
Ott murmured, looking at the display with frightened eyes. Gaunt forced himself to look at the astropath. The stink of the warp hung about the cadaverous wretch. Your opinion? This chatter, could it be the control signal of the Zoikan forces? An addictive broadcast that maintains the Heritor's hold over his zealots?
It is certainly patterned and hypnotic. I find myself reluctant to listen to it for any length of time. It is a chaos pulse, though we daren't interpret its meaning. The flow of the enemy troops and armor seems to match its rhythmic fluctuations.
Gaunt turned away, deep in thought. The idea that had woken him reformed in his mind. I have a notion, he told Dower, Ott, and Bainfail. Send word to Major Rawn's units, and to Sergeant McColl and his scout platoon. He ordered other preparations to be made, and then told Dower to fetch him a fresh box of bolter shells.
Where are you going? We need you here, sir,
stammered Ott. You have my full confidence, Major, Gaunt said. He gestured to the hololithic display. The defense strategies are set in motion. You and this staff are more than able to direct them. I'm a foot soldier, a warrior, not a war master. It's time I did my job, the job I'm best at. And with the grace of the Emperor shining on me, I may take this field yet. Gaunt took Hieronymo's amulet from his pocket and felt it whisper and chuckle in his hand. The flickering light patterns on its carapace roiled like the twisting flashes of the immaterium. In my absence, Ott and Dower have field command. If I fail to return, Intendant, you should signal Warmaster Makaroth and plead for salvation. But I believe it won't come to that. The amulet gurgled and quivered. This could work, thought Gaunt. God Emperor save us.
This could fething work.